I next met with Dr. Suresh Ramalingam, and to begin, he presented a case from his practice that demonstrates one of the most vexing dilemmas in current pulmonary oncology, management of patients with EGFR tumor mutations who respond to an EGFR TKI and then develop disease progression.
So this is a 61-year-old male who was totally doing very well without any major medical issues throughout his life, presents with symptoms of pneumonia and goes to the hospital, first to his physician. He gets some oral antibiotics. Things are not getting better and ends up having further workup with a CT scan, which showed basically bilateral pulmonary nodules and a mass in the right upper lobe. And he had never smoked cigarettes. He had hypertension. He was fully employed. He was working on an administrative position, which involved a lot of walking around within a building and doing work in front of a computer. So we ended up getting a biopsy, and it showed that he had an adenocarcinoma. And in our institution, any patient diagnosed with adenocarcinoma routinely ends up getting molecular profiling done. And in his case, being a never smoker, all the more reason. And when I saw him, I did not have the results of the molecular testing yet, but his symptoms were relatively minimal. I mean, the cough was there. He was getting short-winded sometimes when he walked extreme lengths. But other than that, he was relatively well. So I felt like I could wait for a couple of weeks until I had the molecular data back. And we had him come back. And sure enough, he had an exon 21 EGFR mutation. So we felt that this was a better position to be in, and we talked to him and started him on erlotinib.
Did he have any disease outside the chest?
When he presented, all his disease was restricted to the chest.
So he got started on erlotinib, and what happened?
So he got started on erlotinib, and he was tolerating it fairly well. He got a grade 1 rash and grade 1 diarrhea. We got a scan after 2 months of therapy, and it looked very promising. His tumor had regressed, and the nodules were getting smaller. So we were all very excited, and we told him that he's on the right track, and we recommended continued erlotinib. And things were going well when one fine day he called me and said, I'm feeling something in my neck. So I said, let's bring you into the clinic. And sure enough, he had a palpable, fairly sizable left lower cervical lymph node. And we got him biopsied the same day. And we also completed a restaging workup. And we found some new pulmonary nodules. And the primary tumor mass hadn't increased in size. It was still smaller. But clearly, there were half a dozen new pulmonary nodules bilaterally. And so we ended up sending the cervical biopsy specimen for further molecular testing. It turned out to be adenocarcinoma, and it was clearly something he had not had. And it had also, in addition to the L858R, a T790 mutation on the cervical lymph node biopsy specimen.
So his situation is, I'm going to say, the number one question we get from oncologists as to what do you do? And maybe you could just outline the potential options, not just off protocol, but in terms of clinical research strategies to look at this very situation.
Sure. So 60%, as you know, Neil, are patients who will develop resistance because of the T790 in EGFR mutated lung cancer. And the other 40% from a variety of other mechanisms such as MET amplification and so forth. So for T790 mutated patients, their prognosis seems to be a little better than those who develop resistance from non-T790 mutations based on limited information that's available. I think by far what I've seen as most promising for this subgroup is the combinatorial data with afatinib cetuximab, where in a cohort of well over 100 patients, there was a response rate of about 35%, median PFS of nearly 6 months in a group of patients who had received multiple prior lines of therapy. And this trial was primarily spearheaded by the Memorial and the Vanderbilt groups. So in fact, at ECOG, we're now planning a phase 3 trial with a regimen for exactly this subset of resistant patients. It's still a few months away from getting all the necessary approvals. We remain optimistic that the strength of the data would lead to approval of this trial.
That's another study that, even though it's not that overdue, is still pretty kind of overdue. I mean, I guess it's been about a year and a half since this was presented at ASCO, and it was really impressive. I mean, the waterfall plots looked particularly impressive.
Absolutely.
And so what's the actual design of the study going to be?
So right now, as it stands, it's going to be a randomized comparison of afatinib and cetuximab versus afatinib in the post-TKI setting.
So that sounds like a really attractive trial. Are you all discussing crossover to the combination arm in patients who progress on afatinib alone?
Absolutely. So the primary endpoint for the trial is going to be progression-free survival, and every patient on the afatinib arm would be allowed to cross over if he or she wants it. And it'll also have a biopsy component before they go on the study and an optional component when they progress at the study to understand more about what leads to escape from even combined inhibition.
Yeah, that's going to be a really attractive trial. Can you talk a little bit about, I wasn't so clear from that initial data set that was presented, the toxicity of the combination. You could imagine, particularly dermatologic, these are pretty tough two therapies to combine. What do we know about it?
So skin toxicity is the biggest tolerance issue with this trial. I've had 4 or 5 patients I sent to Vanderbilt for this trial from Emory, and they all clinically did very well for a good length of time, but toxicities of the skin were limiting for at least 2 or 3 of these patients. They are seen primarily in the first few weeks of treatment. If you can get them beyond that with very proactive skin topical therapies that are presently being used for EGFR rash, you have a better chance of getting them beyond that point where the toxicities peak.
I guess another thing relevant to this patient in that initial trial you were talking about of afatinib cetuximab is it looks like the patients with T790 mutations did just as well as those without it.
Yeah, the patients with T790 mutation, in fact, may do a little better compared to non-T790-mediated resistance mechanisms. Again, we don't have a large data set to go with that information, but that seems to be what at least the Dana-Farber series seemed to show.
I guess my recollection, though, was in the cetuximab afatinib trial, they saw, like in the waterfall plot, it kind of looked similar, the kinds of regressions with or without T790.
Sure. Sorry, I misunderstood your question. I think William Pao's preclinical data had originally suggested that T790s are the ones who are going to respond, but the waterfall plot showed that the effectiveness was not restricted to T790. And that's why, as we are talking about the ECOG trial design, we're going to allow all mechanisms of resistance, but clearly get a biopsy to understand that specific factor.
Getting back to this trial, one of the arms is afatinib. Can you talk about what we know about afatinib? There was some data last year in the first line setting, and what we know about it in this situation in people who've progressed on, I guess, erlotinib or gefitinib.
So afatinib, as you know, is the irreversible inhibitor. In preclinical models, they clearly seem to have activity even in erlotinib and gefitinib-resistant cell lines. We have at least 2 irreversible inhibitors that are in advanced clinical trials. The other one is dacomitin. Afatinib has now completed a phase 3 testing in many settings. The most recent one you're referring to is the frontline therapy setting for patients with EGFR mutation. And the results looked very interesting. They compared afatinib to the cisplatin-pemetrexed combination, and essentially there was superiority in progression-free survival. When they specifically looked at the exon 19 and 21 mutations in this trial, the median PFS was over 13 months, which is much more than what we've seen with the first-generation compounds, gefitinib and erlotinib. So it's suggestive of perhaps a greater effect on EGFR-mutated tumors, though it has not yet been head-to-head compared with the first-generation compounds. One issue to contend with is there is a higher incidence of GI toxicity such as diarrhea and mucositis that seems a little more common with the newer irreversible compounds. So what we know from these trials is that afatinib is an effective agent in the frontline setting for EGFR-mutated tumors. When you look at the role of afatinib in patients who've already been treated with gefitinib or erlotinib, I think the randomized trial that they did comparing afatinib to supportive care showed an improvement in PFS, but there was no clear benefit in overall survival. And what that tells me is there is biological activity, perhaps not strong enough by itself to effectively treat those patients. And that's why I think, given what we know, afatinib would be a good frontline drug. For a refractory patient population, we need to wait and see vis-a-vis how this drug compares to some of the other newer or the combo regimen that we just talked about.
Yeah, well, certainly if afatinib's approved, I think a whole lot of people might be, even though there's this trial out there, if they could do it, would probably think about trying to do afatinib cetuximab. But in the interim, I guess, as far as we know, erlotinib cetuximab probably wouldn't work.
So that's been studied in a limited manner. And William Pao's preclinical data seem to suggest that something unique about the irreversible inhibitor with cetuximab. So I'm not sure erlotinib cetuximab is something I would do at this point.
If afatinib were to become available, of course, I guess it's going to depend a lot on what the labeling is or reimbursement and all that. But theoretically, if it were available and you could utilize it to the extent you'd like to, where exactly would you utilize it?
I have not used afatinib myself because we were not part of that clinical trials, but certainly I'm intrigued by the data. And certainly I would like to try it for my frontline patients for EGFR mutated tumors to get a better feel for personal feel for how the tolerability is and so forth. Another setting where I think it's going to get a lot of use is exactly those patients who progress on erlotinib, where you're looking for options and perhaps bringing in afatinib, given that the LUX-1 trial showed PFS benefit with afatinib. So I think that's another setting to consider using. Obviously, that would not be the approved indication at that point. But given that we don't have good options for patients, that would be a reasonable thing to try.
I guess the one question we get the most from clinicians in practice about the situation of the patient who's had a response to erlotinib and then progresses with an EGFR mutation is the idea of switching to chemo, but whether or not you keep the erlotinib going, which I'm starting to hear more investigators talk about. What did you actually do with this man?
When I looked at it, I had the same question that I had to resolve within myself, whether I continue the erlotinib and add chemotherapy or discontinue erlotinib and add chemotherapy. When I looked at a scan, I thought that the response was quite dramatic after the first two cycles. And those tumors that had responded still remained at their best response state. So they were not progressing individually. So my assessment of the picture was he had a clone of cells that were sensitive to erlotinib, but he's clearly repopulated his tumor or populated his tumor with the second clone, which is the T790s. So I explained to him the lack of data to support continuing erlotinib. And on the other hand, we don't have any data to do the other thing either. So I basically ended up keeping the erlotinib on and starting him on combination chemotherapy. And given that he had an excellent performance status, I gave him the cisplatin pemetrexed regimen.
And just kind of curious about your choice of cis in this situation. What were you thinking? What other combinations were you thinking about?
So one approach was to look at carboplatin paclitaxel bevacizumab ECOG-4599 kind of regimen. The other was to go with cis-pemetrexed. So for me, once I made the decision to continue erlotinib, I didn't want to add three more drugs to it. I felt a little better just adding cis-pemetrexed, which, you know, in younger patients with good kidney functions or in situations where you're looking for a response, this gentleman's neck lymph node was growing from nowhere to a sizable mass that you could feel. So I felt that cis-pemetrexed would be a good option for him.
And what happened?
When I saw him back for cycle 2 of therapy 3 weeks later, the lymph node had undergone considerable reduction in size, which was very encouraging, and he was tolerating it fine. He didn't have any undue toxicities. I did ask him to stop taking erlotinib the day before, the day off, and the day after the chemotherapy, just to negate any potential antagonistic effects that some preclinical studies had demonstrated. So that's his regimen. He only starts the erlotinib 2 days after the chemo and continues it until the day before. So we gave him two cycles and then got a scan, and clearly it showed a significant response to treatment at that point. And he was very happy, and so were we. So we continued the treatment for about four cycles, after which I just continued him on erlotinib and pemetrexed. And basically, with that regimen, he continues now almost a year into it. And he has not had any evidence of progression. He has very minimal disease. Those tumors that were originally responding to erlotinib continue to go down in size, interestingly. So it clearly said that this patient has two different clones of cells populating his tumor. He continues to work full-time. He has the occasional diarrhea that he knows how to manage, and things have been going well for him.
So kind of on a related EGFR TKI kind of strain or thought, I've started to see some papers on another TKI, and I actually have seen your name on a couple of them. I think it's called decamitinib.
Yes.
What's the deal with this agent? What do we know about it?
So this is a irreversible EGFR inhibitor along the lines of afatinib that we talked about. This drug has undergone a randomized phase 2 testing. We did a trial comparing it to erlotinib in the BR21 patient population. These are patients with advanced non-small cell who had progressed on one or two prior regimens. And the results were very interesting. There was a clear improvement in PFS with decamitinib compared to erlotinib. And when we looked at, the trial had about 188 patients, and we had tumor tissues in nearly 80% of the patients. So we looked at a variety of underlying mutations in these tumor tissues to see how they predicted for outcome. And what we found was if the tumor had a KRAS wild-type disease, then there was almost a twofold improvement in PFS with decamitinib compared to erlotinib. It was 16 weeks versus 8 weeks, which we were very excited to find. So when you look at the toxicity profile, again, the irreversible compounds do have a slightly higher incidence of diarrhea and skin toxicities, but those were all mostly in the first 4 to 6 weeks with this compound. After that, that was not an issue. We looked at patient-reported outcomes in this trial, and again, it was the first maybe 4 to 6 weeks where you see the differences. After that, there wasn't much of a difference between erlotinib and decamitinib. So the bottom line is the trial met its endpoint. It was positive in favor of the irreversible inhibitor decamitinib. So there is a phase 3 trial that is presently ongoing, very similar design, second or third line therapy of non-small cell lung cancer with co-primary endpoints, one for KRAS wild-type population and the other for the overall population. And this trial actually is almost done with accrual. We expect that in the next 4 weeks or so, the accrual will be completed. Nearly 800 patients have been accrued. So we'll see how the phase 3 trials stand up.
So what do we know about decamitinib compared to erlotinib in patients with EGFR tumor mutations?
Yeah, that's interesting. You bring that question up. At the Chicago meeting, Multidisciplinary Thoracic Symposium meeting a few months ago, we actually presented data from the subset analysis. This was the second, third line population, phase 2 we had done. We had about 30 patients with EGFR mutation on that group, and we looked at how those patients performed in the second or third line setting with decamitinib compared to erlotinib. And we saw that patients with exon 19 or 21 mutation actually had a very favorable hazard ratio with the decamitinib compared to erlotinib. Again, a very small number of patients, but these results suggested to us that the irreversible compound may be associated with a favorable outcome in the mutated patients. Supportive to that is a frontline trial that Mark Criss reported at ESMO meeting recently. He had done a phase 2 trial in EGFR mutated patients with decamitinib as frontline therapy, and the PFS there was approximately 16 to 17 months, which is more than what we see with erlotinib or gefitinib in phase 3 trials. So all of these, to me, line up to indicate that this irreversible compounds may offer more to EGFR mutated patients, and we need to clearly do head-to-head comparator studies.
Any way to indirectly begin to even compare decamitinib to afatinib?
There are preclinical data, but one study that's currently ongoing that's being led by the NCI Canada group is comparing decamitinib to placebo in patients who previously received erlotinib or gefitinib. This is similar to the LUX-1 trial that Vince Miller presented. And when we have the results of the trial, I think we'll have an opportunity to compare notes on these two drugs.
I guess we should point out that the LUX-1 trial was of afatinib.
Right, that LUX-1 was afatinib. The NCI Canada trial is decamitinib. So similar patient population data from two different trials with two different drugs. That's, I think, will give us a chance.
Let's go into your second case, because I think she kind of brings up a bunch of other really important practical issues. Your 64-year-old lady.
Yeah, she's a very interesting lady who's 64 years old. She's retired. She used to work in the local school district as an administrator. And she presented with what seemed to be persistent cough, some decline in her appetite, weight loss. But what precipitated was she was hospitalized with an episode of pneumonia. And at that time, when they got a scan, they found that she had a right lower lobe pneumonia, but also found to have two cavitary lesions in the lung and bilateral pulmonary nodules. So she was tested extensively for infectious etiology that were all excluded, and a biopsy was done, and sure enough, it was consistent with an adenocarcinoma. She had EGFR and ALK testing done and KRAS mutation, and she was negative for all three of them. This was at a point where her functional status was really good. She had an ECOG performance status of 0 to 1. I mean, she was actually doing very well until that. And presented to me for treatment options. And at that point, we recommended that she be treated with carboplatin and pemetrexed. She had prior smoking history, about 25 pack years. She had quit about 5 years earlier in terms of her other illnesses. She also had hypertension and her blood pressure was not perfectly controlled, was moving around. She was on a couple of medicines for that and also had hyperlipidemia, but otherwise, you know, in relatively good health. So we started on carboplatin and pemetrexed. And basically after four cycles, we got a scan after 2 and 4, and she seemed to have not a partial response, but a significant reduction in size of the tumors that didn't meet criteria for partial response. And then we continued her on maintenance therapy with pemetrexed. And as she continued, her disease was under very good control. We continued her for almost 6 months. And then what happened was there was one lesion, which was by far the largest lesion she had, about 5 centimeters in size, started growing. The other spots that we were watching were all very stable. They were not changing. This one lesion that was 5 centimeters had gone up over a 2-scan period from 5 to about 7 centimeters. So the question was whether we switch her to a different treatment regimen or whether we try something unconventional, such as using radiotherapy for the dominant mass and either continuing on our pemetrexed or giving her a treatment break. So when we discussed with her, she was open to receiving radiotherapy to the dominant mass. And so we gave her radiation therapy to that mass. And then we, after the radiation was done, we asked her whether she wanted to continue the pemetrexed or whether take a treatment holiday. And the summer was coming up, so she wanted to take a cruise and go spend some time with her newly born grandkid. So she said, can I be off of chemo for some time? So we said, why not? We will watch you closely. So we stopped the chemo at that point and have been getting CAT scans almost every 2 months on her. And now it's been 7-8 months, and she has not had any disease progression. The spot that we radiated has gone down in size, and her grandkid is almost ready to walk now. And she likes the fact that she's not on any active treatment, and her cancer seems to be under control.
You know, it's interesting, this idea of sort of selectively using local therapy. I've started to hear a little bit about in terms of mutation kinds of situations. Like, for example, I was talking to Ross Camage, and he was talking about ALK patients and, you know, this kind of local sort of pseudo-aggressive approach. What's your experience with this kind of strategy overall, and particularly in wild-type tumors like this lady?
So in EGFR or ALK-dominant patients, we tend to, A, tolerate slow progression a lot more than we do with chemotherapeutic drugs. So if a patient is asymptomatic and is seeing a generic progression, but that's slow, we continue them on the TKI. But if there were one or two areas, or let's say somebody has progression in the brain, my approach has been to treat that local lesion with local therapy and then continue the targeted therapy for as long as possible. And in fact, Ross Camage's group has shown that by doing that, you can probably keep them on a TKI for an extra 4 to 6 months, which is not trivial for our patients, where once you progress and become resistant to targeted therapy, we don't have a lot of great options. So I like that approach. I've used it in several cases for targeted therapy. And that's where this idea of why not trying something local for this patient who seemed to have well-controlled disease came. And I have tried it for selected patients where you see overall disease control, but one or two areas that are progressing using radiation therapy in those situations.
So another point that I think this case brings up, although I know you wanted to point out what you did here locally, but I think it also brings up the question of maintenance treatment. And we saw a very important trial, the so-called Point Break trial, presented not too long ago at the Chicago meeting. And I also see that you've got a really great review article in the journal Lung Cancer, Single Agent Maintenance Therapy for Advanced Non-Small Cell, a meta-analysis that I thought was really interesting. Can you kind of bring us up to date on where we are about maintenance treatment?
Sure. So maintenance therapy clearly is a proven strategy in non-small cell lung cancer. We have erlotinib that's approved for maintenance therapy in the U.S. We have pemetrexed that's an approved agent. And pemetrexed has been approved both in the switch maintenance setting, whereby patients received a frontline chemo doublet that did not include pemetrexed, and then they were switched over to maintenance therapy with pemetrexed. And it's also been approved on the continuation maintenance setting. These are patients who received pemetrexed as part of the frontline regimen and then continued the pemetrexed alone as maintenance therapy. And the hazard ratio both in the switch and the continuation maintenance setting appear to be more or less similar. So I think both of these drugs have potential usage in the maintenance setting. For EGFR TKIs, I tend to use them in patients with a mutation. If they didn't get into the first-line therapy, the TKI, after four cycles of chemo, I put them on maintenance therapy. In the wild-type population, I have not widely adopted the erlotinib maintenance strategy. I tend to use chemotherapy more in maintenance setting. The question is whether every patient needs maintenance therapy. Who do we give it to? The answers, different people have opinions on this. My own approach has been, if a patient presented with bulky or large volume of disease and a lot of symptoms related to lung cancer from that disease, I tend to favor the use of maintenance therapy for those patients. On the other hand, if a patient has oligometastatic disease, has one or two small lesions which qualify as stage four, which warranted chemotherapy, those are the patients I tend to watch closely without maintenance therapy. But obviously, that's not necessarily the only approach that's out there. So clearly, maintenance therapy helps. The reason to consider maintenance is if you assume the approach that as long as you get some chemo after the frontline doublet, they're going to benefit, you will lose 40% of the patients if you just do observation alone after frontline combination chemotherapy, as was shown in the early versus delayed docetaxel trial. So you give four cycles of chemo, your patient has obtained some benefit. If you sit and wait until they progress to give second line, 40% of the time, chances are you're not going to give them chemo, and they lose out that benefit from subsequent chemo. So by giving maintenance to those patients, you're making sure a greater group of patients receive an active therapy. And I think that is my rationale to use maintenance therapy in that setting.
What about the degree or lack of degree of response? Does that factor into your decision?
The difference between whether achieving a response versus stable disease impacts outcome of subsequent therapy, I think it came up because in Europe, erlotinib is approved only for patients who achieved stable disease with frontline chemo for maintenance therapy. I'm not particularly compelled to think that you use the fact that patient responded versus just had stable disease to decide maintenance versus no maintenance. I don't find that helpful yet based on the available data. So I use maintenance therapy whether or not they had an objective response if I feel maintenance is indicated. The other approach, I just complete the loop on maintenance that we talked about, is use of bevacizumab. Because in the ECOG 4599 trial, patients who got chemotherapy with bevacizumab continued on Bev maintenance. And therefore, for patients you treat with combination therapy and bevacizumab, continuing bevacizumab alone as maintenance therapy is a standard approach, which is what we do for those patients in our practice.
Could you comment on the Point Break trial, specifically in terms of what it looked at, what it found, what you think it means, and also the ongoing ECOG study looking at this question?
So the Point Break trial was built upon the results of the Giorgio Scagliotti trial, which showed that the cis-pemetrexed combination was superior to cis-gemcitabine in non-squamous histology. And the notion was whether pemetrexed, which is superior to gemcitabine in non-squamous, would also be superior to taxanes. So the phase 2 trial Dr. Patel from Northwestern had done with carboplatin, pemetrexed, and bevacizumab, followed by dual maintenance, bevacizumab and pemetrexed, for those who had stable disease or a response, showed a robust PFS of nearly 7.5 months overall survival of nearly 15 months. So that regimen was directly compared to the carboplatin paclitaxel bevacizumab followed by bevacizumab. That's the 4599 regimen. So that was the point break trial to compare the PATEL regimen versus the ECOG 4599 regimen. So the differences in the trial were the ECOG 4599 used taxane with carboplatin, paclitaxel with carboplatin as the backbone, and the Jyoti PATEL regimen used carboplatin, pemetrexed, BEV, followed by maintenance therapy with both drugs, pemetrexed and BEV. And the trial was designed to show superiority for the carbo-pem-BEV regimen, but the results were very similar between the two arms of the trial. It was not superior. The carboplatin paclitaxel BEV arm did just as well as the carbo-pem-BEV followed by dual maintenance strategy. So it was negative. In terms of tolerability, very predictable lines. Neuropathy was more common with the paclitaxel arm, slightly higher incidence of platelet toxicity and anemia with the pemetrexed arm. So there wasn't a clear winner between the two. The one interesting analysis which was done in a post hoc manner was if patients got to the maintenance part, whether dual maintenance was better than single maintenance. Now, this was not a primary randomization. This was not a planned analysis. But the trends appear to suggest that patients who got both PEM and BEV in the maintenance part, if they got to maintenance therapy, was a little better compared to bevacizumab alone. So that brings up an important question, which is whether maintenance therapy with the combination is better than bevacizumab or pemetrexed alone. So that's what we're testing in the ECOG 5508 phase 3 trial, which is coming along quite well, where we give patients four cycles of carboplatin, paclitaxel, and BEV, like we did in 4599, and those who have a partial response or a stable disease or complete response, the non-progressors, they get randomized to either continuing bevacizumab or switching to pemetrexed or getting both drugs. And the primary endpoint is overall survival. This trial will need nearly 1,300 patients, and we've accrued about 500 patients now. So the optimal maintenance strategy, I think, will be answered by the ECOG trial that's ongoing. So coming back to point break, I think what it told us is, while pemetrexed is better than gemcitabine in non-squamous patients, the taxanes do just as well as pemetrexed for non-squamous histology. So the carboplatin paclitaxel BEV regimen is just as good as the pemetrexed BEV-based regimens for our patients.
So I see that actually you were part of a poster at the ASTRO meeting looking at, I guess, a sort of an online tool based on investigator practice patterns as it relates to first-line and maintenance therapy. And, you know, just sort of asking people what they do is one of our favorite things, too. And I'm curious right now in terms of the, you know, usual patient who has metastatic wild-type adenocarcinoma, you know, who's in good condition, younger, BEV eligible, what's your usual first-line treatment and your usual maintenance treatment, if any?
Sure. So for those patients, our standard approach has been to go with the ECOG regimen of carboplatin, paclitaxel, bevacizumab, and continue with bevacizumab maintenance. Now, in patients who have some comorbid illnesses or where there are contraindications to bevacizumab, we also use the pemetrexed-based regimens quite often. What is different now after point break is the carboplatin, PEM, bevacizumab, all three drugs, we are seeing some pushback from some of our payers. So that may not be something that may be readily available to everyone to use. So in a young patient who we are looking for response for improvement of symptoms, then we feel more strongly about using CIS-PEM or the carbopaclitaxel bevacizumab regimen.
So one other new approach that I wanted to get your take on is targeting MET and specifically MET-MAB, the monoclonal antibody, as well as also tivantinib. Can you talk a little bit about these strategies and what we know about them?
So, you know, in patients who are exposed to EGFR TKIs, when one looks at mechanisms of resistance after continued use of an EGFR TKI, in addition to the T790 mutation we talked about as the most common mechanism, there are patients who develop activation of the MET pathway that contributes or leads to resistance. So targeting MET or co-targeting MET along with EGFR in order to delay the emergence of resistance is a very attractive strategy, and that led to randomized trials using MET inhibitors. MetMab is a monoclonal antibody against MET receptor, and in a randomized phase 2 trial, David Spiegel and colleagues actually compared erlotinib to erlotinib plus MetMab in the second or third line patient population. Essentially, the trial showed that for the overall patient population, there was no difference between the two groups. However, the investigators were very astute to collect tumor specimens and look at MET expression as a predictive marker. And interestingly, patients whose tumors had MET expression, the PFS almost doubled for the combination of MetMab with erlotinib. Whereas for the MET non-expressing or low expressors, the results were quite in the opposite direction. So this basically educated us that patients whose tumors had MET expression can be treated with the combination and potentially derive benefit. But if you give it to a MET negative patient, you're not going to see much of an effect. So there is an ongoing phase 3 trial only for patients whose tumors express the MET receptor by IHC, randomizing them to erlotinib alone versus erlotinib plus MetMab. The other compound that's also been studied is tivantinib. This is actually a tyrosine kinase inhibitor, unlike MetMab, which is a monoclonal antibody. And that too, in a randomized phase 2 trial, showed favorable results over erlotinib alone when you combine tivantinib with erlotinib. And in that trial, they noticed that non-squamous patients did better with the combination compared to squamous. So their phase 3 follow-up study compared the combination of tivantinib plus erlotinib to erlotinib in the non-squamous patient population. They did not use any biomarker-based selection for this phase 3 trial. Now, even though we don't know the actual results of the trial, we know from a press release that the trial did not meet its primary endpoint. So we'll have to see what the data show and also whether any potential biomarker work done on an exploratory basis or post hoc basis will show us the effect of MET expression in patients treated with this combination. So what we are left with now is an ongoing trial with MetMab and erlotinib in MET positive patients, which I think is very intriguing.
So I would like to ask you, it's kind of hard to get any discussion going nowadays of small cell lung cancer, and I see you've got a couple publications, one with the PARP inhibitor and some other work looking at tissue markers. I'm curious what's going on in terms of small cell and whether or not, you know, there's any sort of hope for the near future.
So you're right, Neil. The small cell lung cancer has seen very little progress in the past two decades. And looking at this disease in a different way, perhaps doing in-depth studies to identify target-driving mutations or pathways is going to be very important. What the Eastern Cooperative Oncology Group has adopted is looking at novel agents in combination with existing chemotherapy backbone. So a randomized phase 2 trial that compared cisplatin etoposide to the combination plus an hedgehog inhibitor, that's the GDC-0449, vismodegib, versus the same chemo combination plus IMC-A12, which is the IGF-1R inhibitor. So this was about 180 patient trial, randomized phase 2, to identify whether one or both novel approaches would be better than standard treatment. And we'll have the results at ASCO 2013, hopefully, since this trial has completed accrual a few months ago. The follow-up study that ECOG is pursuing is to combine a PARP inhibitor with a common chemo backbone. We're using veliparib, which is a clean PARP inhibitor, in the setting. And this is built on preclinical data at our own institution where we've seen significant synergy between PARP inhibition and chemotherapy. And we also have a potential biomarker that may predict who might benefit. So the ECOG randomized phase 2 trial will look for an overall signal, but also honed in on this biomarker as a potential predictive marker. So that's sort of where our research efforts are focused on, finding new novel agents. But clearly at the laboratory level, doing more detailed molecular analysis of small cell specimens to identify some new targets is going to be the key moving forward.